Insight on Business the NewsHour is made possible through the support of Focus and Find, helping you turn human resources into a profit zone rather than an expense. Focusandfind.com.
Welcome back to Insight on Business the NewsHour. Grateful you're listening to us from wherever on the planet you happen to live. With us is an economist, and we're going to be talking about jobs, job searching, enhanced unemployment benefits, a whole host of things. His name is Dave Swenson. He is an economist at Iowa State University, and I am grateful that he is spending some time with us today to weed through this very complex issue. Dave, welcome to the Business News Hour. Grateful that you're carving out some time to be with us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, this is, as I forwarded that a bit of information to our listeners, this is a thing that we're seeing not only in Iowa, but across the United States, where, we just had a story about this the other day, where in the 26 states, I believe it is, that cut enhanced benefits for unemployment, we've seen job upticks at 1.33% in those states that did not cut benefits. The job uptick was 1.37%. Kind of a wash, isn't it?
It is kind of a wash. There's different ways to analyze this. I did my own analysis of this a few weeks ago, and what I did was I looked at the very same thing, but I looked at the states that had what are called statistically significant changes in employment. Remember that these surveys of businesses have ranges of confidence. And if there isn't a big enough change for it to exceed their confidence level, their margin of error, then they say, well, you know, it may have grown or it may not have grown. But I looked at the states that had statistically significant rates of employment change. Among those who that retained their emergency unemployment benefits, the average was 0.9% growth. That's non-farm payroll jobs. Those who eliminated emergency unemployment benefits, the growth was 0.7% growth. So they, in fact, did worse. So there are different ways that we can measure it. Now, there's other ways and somewhat better ways to measure it. They have people who have access to better information, people that actually have access to the individual unemployment records. Well, not necessarily the individual, but that mass of unemployment records, and are able to track the behavior as to whether you were receiving benefits or not receiving benefits, and the likelihood of you seeking a job over the course of the month. And they did find that within the states that had eliminated the benefits, there was about a 2 percentage point increase in the rate of hires among them than among those folks who did not have benefits. So again, it's not the kind of effect that people thought was going to happen. People assumed that if we snap that whip, if we swing that stick and take away all of the carrots, workers are going to flood back into the workforce. And that did not happen.
It did not happen. And we're seeing that all over. Are the numbers that we're looking at, Dave, are they a lagging indicator number? Because I'm just wondering, we're looking at data from, what, June, July? I'm not sure where August is at this point. But are those lagging indicators?
They are lagging indicators. We have only data for the states up through the individual states up through August. Through July. August numbers we have nationally. The state numbers will come out in a week or so, and we'll get another handle on that. But remember, at the national level, job growth in August was very disappointing.
Yes.
People saying that was mostly attributable to the Delta variant, but it could be other factors as well. We have all of those things coming in. What we don't know is the Delta variant, notwithstanding, you hold that as a constant. Again, did the states that had eliminated benefits perform better, the same, or worse? And we're gonna find that out in just a couple of weeks.
And about those August numbers, they were not just disappointing, they were downright awful.
They were awful. And the area that everybody seems to fixate on and perhaps doesn't understand very well is the leisure and hospitality sector, dining, drinking, and hotels. That sector did not grow at all over the course of August.
Yeah, and just to refresh individuals, the economists on Wall Street had expected over 700,000 jobs to be created in August, and it was well under 300,000 jobs. And so, yeah, it was not a good job growth time. So, yes, they are saying, Dave Swenson, they are saying that it is effectual to Delta variant of COVID-19. But there are other factors that are creeping into this, from work-life balance to pay to benefits to the opportunity to work from home. All those are new variables since COVID, yes?
Yes, they are. And yours and my hypothetical willingness to participate in the economy broadly has changed. And that is something that actually stood out much more for a state like Iowa, and again, some of the other states as well, than some of the other things that we're worried about. And that factor is that we had in Iowa a very sharp reduction in our labor supply. Our labor supply, when the early parts of the pandemic, it contracted just like the jobs that were lost. Our labor supply contracted sharply as well. And labor suppliers are people who are working and those people who are officially unemployed, either receiving benefits or looking for work. So that's our labor supply. Well, nationally, when the jobs started to bounce back up in May, June, July, and August of 2020, so did the national labor supply. It recovered. Iowa's didn't. Iowa's continued to contract through June, July, August, all the way into October before it started to recover. And so Iowa's labor supply, percentage-wise, contracted more than twice as much as the national contraction. We're still somewhere under 4%, well, we're over 4% more or fewer workers, fewer labor supply members than we had pre-pandemic, whereas the U.S. is down about 2%. So it's something about Iowa that is we don't understand very well. We've looked at some preliminary statistics. We really don't understand why was Iowa so much different than the nation. But that in and of itself explains a big fraction of Iowa employers struggling to find labor. Way more people left the labor force than were unemployed.
It's an amazing statistic. And while we're looking at all of these things, the question has to be, well, where did these folks go? As we know, many women simply left the labor force simply because they were schooling at home. They had child care issues. There is no affordable daycare, apparently, in many places. And so in many families, women have just said, well, we're going to take a step back and not go into the labor force. Is that part of what we're looking at?
Yeah, it's multifaceted, but yes, that's one assumption, and that was borne out relatively well in national statistics. We do not have good indicators of the degree of workforce participation among women, let's say under 45. We don't have really good indicators. What we do know is that the cohort that had the greatest reduction in workforce participation over the course of the year 2020 was women 45 to 54, which wouldn't be women mothers who would be taking care of small children or necessarily overseeing young elementary school aged children. So that part isn't, that doesn't quite align very well. Well, we have several reasons why people left. First of all, we do know that there was an increase in early retirements and or retirements in general. People relatively willing to continue working past age 65, 66. Both of those factors, they left the workforce. They may have left earlier than they wanted to, but they left the workforce. We had people that were in high-risk occupations. Many of them left the workforce. You can think in terms of an older school teacher or perhaps older workers in healthcare. Again, close to retirement, decided the risks weren't worth it. They left the workforce. They may come back into the workforce, but right now, given the Delta variant, there isn't any kind of signal that tells them it's safe to come back. Some people burned out and just, you know, they got worked They were frontline workers, and they worked their heinies off, and that's it. They said that's enough. And then in other situations, I think that we have families that, given everything that's happened over the course of the last 15, 18, 16 months, some families said, you know, we don't need the extra money so much as what we really need to do is be safe. I need to take care of the children, whether it's the mother or the father, and that we're going to, for a period of time, we're going to shrink our budgets a little bit and live a little bit more safely and securely. All of those things. And then we have this last thing. This last thing is that we are now getting evidence that says a lot of people see this as an opportunity to stop doing what made them miserable and to try to find other kinds of jobs. And perhaps this is where I said at the beginning, yours and my relationship with the workforce very well may have changed, that the collective willingness of people to do certain kinds of work has changed.
One of the things that is also evident is we've seen consumer spending take a dive across the United States as well. That could be incorporated into the fact that enhanced benefits are not there. But when we take a look at the numbers, and again, we had this story, I believe it was last week, where you have the federal government pumping in roughly $33, $35 billion into the economy through these enhanced benefits. When those go away, that number shrinks down to $3 billion. That must have an impact. Dave Swenson, economist from Iowa State University, that must have an impact on the overall economic growth of this country, would it?
Oh, of course it does. What you're doing is you're removing spending that would have occurred primarily on Main Street, the kind of spending that households make. They pay their rent, they pay their mortgage, they buy gasoline, they go to the grocery store. That's what they spend their money on. To the degree that they can, they pay for childcare and all the other kinds of payments that a household makes. That money that was being received either through the enhanced unemployment benefits, remember the enhanced unemployment benefits didn't just go to conventional unemployed people. It went to people that would otherwise have qualified for unemployment, either by they didn't have enough quarters, enough base quarters of employment, or people who were small shop owners or gig workers like Uber drivers or food service drivers or other kinds of workers. So we were providing a benefits to people who otherwise wouldn't have gotten those benefits. And those folks are not high wage earning people for the most part. And those benefits were getting spent. So we know that for the 26 states that eliminated benefits early, they have to have seen a sharp reduction in consumer spending. And for the remaining half that lost their benefits this week, we are going to see a sharp reduction in consumer spending. And that reduction in consumer spending has a local multiplier. If you reduce your spending on local goods and services, that has a negative multiplier effect across the rest of the economy, as because then it reduces those suppliers' demand for goods and services, and it just keeps going on.
It does.
So that's the end. But that's, you flip it around and put a plus sign. That's what happens when you get a stimulus. And when we got the stimulus, the different forms of stimulus in the form of unemployment assistance and or direct payments to families or households and children, those were a positive stimulus, increased spending, and had a positive multiplier. So we're to the degree right now it's we're working at cross purposes. At one point we're boosting the economy, now we're letting the economy deflate a little bit.
And it's not being felt in all sectors, I suspect. Those individuals who have jobs, they may work remotely, they may have opportunities to be white collar workers. They have the advantage and can continue to work. However, I would suspect most individuals that are in, again, as you indicated, Dave Swenson, in low-pay jobs, they're not as eager to go get a job. And that's one of the interesting things about this. When people say, well, you know, we have all of these job openings, we don't have any people to fill them. And as a matter of fact, even pre-COVID, that was the issue. I know that in certain parts of the state of Iowa, for example, there were at one time pre-COVID 20,000 jobs more than what there were people to fill them. So we've just exacerbated that, I would suspect.
We have. Pre-COVID, it was common for me to see among food service establishments, help wanted signs, and signs advertising substantially higher starting pay than the minimum wage. The issue with staffing existed. But you know, the biggest categories, you know, I'm looking at this right now, the top 25 occupations that are being that the Iowa Department of Workforce Development has listed, 47% of that top 25 of jobs that are listed are in the healthcare sector. 47%, more than half, or no, just less than half, I mean. But that was exactly the way it was prior to the pandemic. A big fraction, that sector was way short on jobs prior to the pandemic. Leisure and hospitality among that top 25 is only 4.8%. Well, that's the sector that's getting all of the press. Mm-hmm. But that sector, you know, it's one of these, we can analyze these numbers. They've recovered 81% of the jobs that they had lost as of April 2020. They've recovered 81%. They've done a darn good job of recovering. It's still a lot of jobs that they haven't filled, but they've done quite a good job of recovering. Other sectors haven't done so well. The construction sector has only recovered 18% of all of the lost jobs. The government sector has only recovered 40% of all the lost jobs. The wholesale delivery sector has only recovered 35% of the lost jobs. So we've got different performances across different sectors.
We do. And one of the interesting things that happened in the state of Iowa was that, just a week ago, I believe it was, that the health department said, look, if you want to become a certified nursing assistant in any one of the nursing homes or long-term care facilities within the state, you no longer have to go to CNA school. You can skip those 75 hours of training and get a job.
That's scary. I have a daughter who's just starting out as a registered nurse, and I remember her taking her certified nursing assistant courses and her advanced certified nursing assistants courses, because that's what you need to do before you can go into nursing school. And by golly, that was hard work, and she learned a lot of stuff. And you know, I assume some professions can be trained on the job, and I understand some of that, but that's still scary to me.
Yeah, especially when you're taking a look at the dearth of employees in the healthcare sector. Our guest is Dave Swenson, ladies and gentlemen. He is a economist with Iowa State University. We're talking about the whole job picture. All right, I'm going to switch gears here for just a moment. What are the steps that employers perhaps need to recognize, in your opinion, to be able to attract workers and even retain them? What do you think, Dave?
Well, first of all, attracting workers, we're economists, you know, we're going to say, okay, we're going to look at pay first. And how's pay been? And is pay enough? Then we ask the question, and pay isn't enough. What are some of the factors that determine whether somebody not just wants to take a job, but wants to take a job in a particular area? And I don't mean area as in classification of occupation or industry. I'm talking about geography. Where do I want to live? All of those things factor into people's willingness. I can be a small manufacturer in North Central Iowa, advertise for an engineer at pay substantially higher than the area average, and still not get any applicants, because some people just don't want to go live in North Central Iowa, because perhaps where they want to live is where things are hip and happening, and they think the Des Moines Metro might be where they want to be. Or they might think the Quad Cities or the Twin Cities or wherever. And so where you are and what that presents to you in terms of not just pay, but opportunities, amenities, opportunities for a spouse, all of those things affect people's decision as to where to live and the kinds of jobs that they're going to take. So it's not just whether they're being paid enough. there's broader categories of quality of life and lifetime expectations that factor in as well.
There truly are. And we can't necessarily invent mountains or oceans or beaches in the state of Iowa or in the Midwest. But I would suspect that there are ways that employers might be able to incorporate a better quality of life. There is a quality of life that is unmatched, Dave Swenson, if you go to some rural parts of the country. And if you like that, and if you can remote work at the same time, but there are so many people that are disadvantaged because A, they may not have broadband capabilities, B, they may not have the necessary education or experience to get there.
Yeah, it's an opportunity for some of the more rural areas. Again, for those folks who like that kind of place. But the statistics tell us another thing. People migrate towards where they think they're going to get work. And where that is currently is in and around those growth metropolitan areas.
Yep. Dave Swenson, ladies and gentlemen, he is an economist with Iowa State University. Dave, thank you so very much for spending this quality time with me and trying to dig out some of this rationale for what's going on in the job market, in particular, where we are really lagging as it comes to employment, not only in the state of Iowa, but also nationally. Dave, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Once again, that's Iowa State University economist Dave Swenson. And yes, we will have links to Dave's program up on our radio blog. That's a wrap for today. Thanks so very much for being with us. For all of us that put this together each and every day, Chap Ramsey is our production coordinator. Sales and marketing, Aaron Libby, the voice of the Business News Hour is Hunter Pease. And the music you're listening to right now was arranged, composed, and conducted by our friend James Goodlett of Jam Good Productions. For all those folks and for economist Dave Swenson, my name's Michael Libby. Have yourself a great day. Be safe, be well, be careful. Most of all, be good to your fellow man. Good day.